Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and this is the second day of our almost live coverage of the 74th Society of Vertebrate Paleontology annual meeting held here in Berlin, Germany. Today's episode is jam-packed with the latest research from the field of vertebrate paleontology, and we even managed to get a listener-requested interview, so ask and you shall receive. Unfortunately, as a presenter, you sometimes have off days, and today's challenges proved insurmountable for me, so I'd appreciate it if you could send in your paleontological tongue twisters just to make me feel a little bit better. Anyway, as always, we'd appreciate any likes, comments, and shares, and we hope you all enjoy this episode. So Brooks Britt of Bingham University,
Brigham Young University.
So Brooks Britt of, how many
Brooks Bradley Britt, Brooks Brigham Young, now I can't even say it.
Brooks Bradley Britt from Brigham Young
University. Let's try it again.
I think that might be a good enough intro to you. Alright, so. I can't do it. Right,
And you, this is why you're not in broadcast journalism, right here. This is why you're working on ostracods.
Right. Can you introduce yourself and tell us what you do, please?
My name is Brooks Britt, and I'm with Brigham Young University, and I dabble in detrital zircon age determination of terrestrial dinosaur bone-bearing beds.
So that's really working out how old some dinosaur deposits
right.
are. So what is the deposit that you're looking to date?
It's a Zigong Dinosaur Museum bone-bearing unit, the Xie Shax Miao formation in Sichuan, China. And so it's like the Dinosaur National Monument of China, this huge building that covers about an acre of dinosaur bones in situ. And so the ages have long been thought to be, of these beds, thought to be Middle Jurassic. But there's been no radiometric dates, no really tie-ins. It's always they're trying to correlate with other bone beds for which they don't know the ages either, assumed to be Middle Jurassic. So we went in, extracted detrital zircons from these rocks, came up with some about the youngest crystals we found, 177 million years old. So that's the bottom bracket. That tells us that these bones cannot be any older than 177 million years old. And that's how it works. And now hopefully we'll find an upper bracket too to narrow down the range. So they could still be Middle Jurassic in age.
So how do you work out the age of a deposit based on the crystals? Is it something in the chemistry?
You use the ratio of, we just take zircon crystals, which are almost immortal. They're hard, they're dense, and you cannot heat them up enough to reset the clock in Mother Nature. And so we crush the rock to size of flour and sort through it and find these crystals. And we blast them with, a laser that ablates the material, whisks off the ablated material, the ions through a helium-filled tube, run it through a mass spectrometer, and we measure the ratios of the uranium and lead isotopes. And you blast that thing with the computer, and within about 2 minutes, you have your age for each crystal.
So it works on something like half-lives, is that right? Or I just got this completely wrong?
That's right. You go look at the half-lives. The original zircon crystals have uranium substitutes in there for the zirconium, and there's no daughter product, which would be the lead. So we measure the ratio of this of the daughter product to the primary product, which would be the uranium. Yeah, and it gives us, using known decay rates, gives the age 177 million years.
So why do we need to know exactly how old these deposits are? What's wrong with just saying that they're roundabout Jurassic?
Well, it's hard to do evolutionary studies. It's hard to compare one fauna to another and know whether it's some evolutionary differences due to time, or is it environmental differences? We're looking at the same slot of time, but different environments. This helps us figure that out. and it allows us to correlate from one continent to another. What's going on with the Middle Jurassic dinosaurs in China versus those from, let's say, somewhere in Europe? It allows you to do that. It cuts down the arm waving.
So is this something that was just missing from the Zeegon formation, or is this something that's really been done for the first time here and should be done on other dinosaur posits worldwide?
People are starting to use detrital zircons in a lot of areas now, because you don't have to have a discrete volcanic ash. Normally, to get an age, you have to have a lava flow or an intrusion or volcanic ash raining down. Here, you can use reworked zircons that have been eroded off surrounding areas. At least that gives you a bottom bracket age. So it helps a lot.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So probably the most famous locality for finding dinosaurs in the world is the Late Jurassic Morrison Formation of the United States. And Emma Hoffman of the University of Pennsylvania has been looking at the taphonomic biases in the Morrison Formation. So can you tell us what it is exactly you've been trying to find out?
Sure. So in 2012, Caleb Brown looked at the dinosaur park formation of the Cretaceous, and he's also looked at Hell Creek at this point, and found that there was a significant correlation between body size and how complete a thing was. Things that were less than 60%, less than 60 kilograms were significantly less complete, and everything that was 60 kilograms and greater was significantly more complete. So he suggested that the same sort of biases would be present in the Morrison Formation. So we decided to take a look at that, and what we found was that it really didn't. We followed all the methods that Caleb did to the T, but for some reason we found absolutely no correlation between body size and completeness, and there were two groups that showed up, one of less than 30% complete and one of greater than 60% complete, but we can't really figure out why those groups were showing up at this point. We're thinking that it's mostly environmental differences between the depositional environment of the Morrison versus Dinosaur Park, because Dinosaur Park is a much wetter environment, so thus better for preservation than the Morrison. We tried all sorts of methods to replicate the results a little bit better. We tried to remove sauropods, which made the correlation worse. We divvied up the formation based on locality, since the Morrison is bigger both temporally and in terms of actual size, and that didn't work. Though we got one very interesting result, where in the Garden Park locality, we actually got a significant result, but in the opposite direction that we were expecting. The smaller bodied dinosaurs were significantly more complete than the larger bodied dinosaurs. So we're really not entirely sure what's going on there either. And we also thought that maybe the small-bodied dinosaurs had all been in lakes or something like that, and as it turns out, they were not. So we're really not entirely sure of what's going on, but it's definitely an odd result and an interesting result, and I can't wait to get it published.
So you mentioned an original study that you copied. What kind of reasons did they give for their taphonomic biases? You said that it was more complete, bigger than smaller specimens?
Yes. The idea was that the smaller specimens are more gracile in terms of the actual bones. They're easier. It's easier for them to break during deposition. It's easier for them to be eroded away during fossilization processes. And the larger bones just were more sturdy and stayed much more complete throughout the fossilization process. So we were thinking that it would make sense that the same sort of thing would be present in Morrison as it was in Hell Creek. But apparently not. Different depositional environments, I guess.
So have you got any idea of where you want to look next to try and work out what's going on? Any further research that you're going to do?
Well, I'd probably like to continue to work on this project. I need a lab and I need funding. I just graduated my undergraduate from Penn, so...
Hint, hint.
but I really would love to continue working on this, because I would like to find out what's going on, because it really is just it's an interesting puzzle that I'm really enjoying working with.
So for now, we just don't know.
We just don't know.
Well, best of luck finding out.
Thank you.
So, Giorgio...
Giorgio Georgalis.
I'm having such a bad time pronouncing names. Right, hang on. I'll let you pronounce your own name and where you're from.
No problem.
And then I'll jump in.
I know it very well, I think.
No.
Yes, it's Georgios Georgalis.
Right. And you've been looking at, I can't even say the name of the animal.
Laophis crotaloides. It was a giant viper.
Right, there we go. I can pronounce that. So you've got a giant viper. Yes. Where did you find this snake?
This snake was originally found in northern Greece and studied by the great Sir Richard Owen. The type of material was housed in London in the Natural History Museum. Unfortunately, now it's lost. And no new material have been found until very, very recently that we have found this single vertebra. This single vertebra comes from the same exactly locality as Laophis crotaloides that was studied by Owen and bears the same characteristics. The anatomy is clearly viperid, and we used mathematical models to estimate not only the body length, but also the body mass. In terms of body length, we used four dimensions of the vertebra, and we used also a data set of 30 modern snakes, not only vipers, but also other snakes. And with these mathematical models, we extracted a huge body length, which is bigger than the largest viper that was known up to now, which is the Amazon Lachesis muta, the Bushmaster. But also, in terms of body mass, it is the heaviest venomous snake of all that ever lived. It is much heavier than the king cobra of Asia, of Theophagus hanna. And we also made some paleotemperature estimations
based on
the size of the snake, because snakes are ectothermic reptiles, so they can imply a lot about the temperature of this time. And we estimated that the temperature of the locality in northern Greece at the early Pliocene that this snake was living was much hotter than today, much, much hotter. And the other estimations were based on mammals.
Okay. So snakes have many, many vertebrae.
Yes.
And you found only one.
Yes.
So how do you know which vertebrae it is? Could it have been the very first vertebrae and then the biggest? Or could it have been the very last and you've got an even bigger snake?
Main problem, that we had only one vertebra. And so for this reason, we used a mathematical model. First of all, before of the size estimates, to estimate where is this vertebra. So we first estimated the vertebral position, and we found all the snakes, extant snakes, and then with only our vipers from our sample, that the results agree, and we are pretty sure, are pretty confident where this vertebra exactly belonged in the column of the snake. And after that, we applied the mathematical models to make the estimations about the body length and the body mass. It's more mathematics than paleontology.
Yeah. So why do you think Greece has the biggest snakes?
This is the mystery, because at that time, at Pliocene of Greece, we find, apart from this giant viper, we find another species of giant viper, we find varanid lizards, and also giant tortoises, and also large cobras. Why there was such a reptilian gigantism in the Pliocene of Greece remains to be studied.
All right, thank you very much.
I thank you very much.
Joe Keating here, reporting for paleocast.com. I'm here with Davide Foffa.
Davide.
Hello.
Can you tell us, you had a presentation today. What were you presenting?
Yes. I was presenting a little piece of work which reported a new cranial material for Metorhynchid crocodilomorph, which I described with Mark Young.
A Metorhynchid?
Yes.
So this is a crocodile-like thing?
Yes, it's a crocodilomorph from the Mesozoic, fully adapted to marine lifestyle.
Excellent. Where is this specimen from?
There are a few specimens. So the holotype was described in 2013, and it is in Glasgow, in the Ontario Museum, while the new specimens are from the NHM and the Peterborough Museum.
Ah, and what they found around Peterborough?
They found a few more. Okay, the holotype was lower jaw and few postcranial material. Now we can we have skull material as well. So we have skull material from the NHM and skull material from Peterborough.
And what does your new material on this crocodilomorph tell you about its lifestyle and its habitat?
It helps to clarify a few questions that were not that clarified only from the holotype. So we are now able to assess better that it was the first Macrophagus metaurinchid.
It was the first what, sorry?
Macrophagus, means... Macrophagus is... it has been defined in various ways, but we can, for simplicity, say that it's the adaptation to feed on large body prey size.
Okay. So this was eating big things?
Yeah, basically.
How big is this crocodile thing?
That's a good question. So we have that the largest specimen has been estimated to be about 5 meters long. But there is evidence that it was an immature, morphologically immature individual because its vertebrae are not completely fused, so it was could probably grow longer than 5 meters.
Okay, so a very, very big.
Yeah, it's certainly the biggest in Middle Jurassic, and probably the second biggest metaurinchid found so far.
And so you said that the fossil is from the Middle Jurassic. How long did the metaurinchids last until?
Till early end of the early Cretaceous.
Okay, and what's next for Davide Foffa?
Next for Davide Foffa is description of few specimens and then focusing on my PhD. My PhD is on ecology of marine reptiles from the Oxford clay and Kimmeridge clay formation.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David.
So someone we got asked to interview, and I've managed to hunt him down, interrupt his beer. So this is real important.
That's right.
And that is Tom Holtz Jr. So hi, Tom. Thanks for talking to us.
Not a problem. Great to be here.
So you're a tyrannosaur worker, is that right?
That's right. Most of my research has focused on tyrannosaurs, the tyrant dinosaurs. Now, when I started off, there were just the Tyrannosauridae known. Those are the giant, two-fingered, big-headed tyrannosaurs, things like Tyrannosaurus and Gorgosaurus and Aspletosaurus. And a lot of my original dissertation work looked at trying to fit where the tyrannosaurs fit on the family tree. For a long time, people had assumed because they were giant predators that they were associated with other giant predatory dinosaurs like Allosaurus and Acrocanthosaurus and so forth. But there had been a minority opinion that was tyrannosaurs were derived from small-bodied forms of the Jurassic and subsequently became huge. Well, when I was getting started, I was sort of the second wave of the cladistic studies of dinosaurs. The first ones just got the big picture of Ornithischians and the bird hip dinosaurs and the big picture of the origin of birds and not care about what's going on in some of the details on the sides. And so in that second wave, I was one of the people who cared about the details on the sides. And I found that the giant tyrants were in fact small bird-like dinosaurs grown huge. And so we predicted eventually we'd find small-bodied, long-armed, three-fingered hand dinosaurs in the Jurassic and Cretaceous that would be closer to Tyrannosaurus than to other known forms. And I've been happy to say that in the last 15 to 20 years, they've been popping up all over, mostly North America and Asia, but also in Europe, and maybe Tyrannosaur relatives in the Southern Hemisphere too, that do confirm that Tyrannosaurs are Celurosaurs grown to enormous size. So I've been happy about that. But I've been working on various other aspects of dinosaur biology and dinosaur history. And one of my current interests is the diversity patterns of dinosaurs through time and the potential signal that we're getting when we look at simple raw data, and how much of that is real and how much of that has to do with collecting biases for both geological and anthropogenic or human reasons. So one pattern that people have noticed for generations is that we have this phenomenal diversity of Western North America, or what are called Laramidian dinosaurs. In the late Cretaceous, Western North America separated from the rest of the world by a shallow seaway, well, particularly the rest of Western America. So a seaway that ran from what's today Texas up over Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas, the Prairie Provinces, all the way up to the Arctic Ocean.
And the Western Interior Seaway, is that?
Exactly. That's the Western Interior Seaway that separated Laramidia from the part of the continent that I live on, which would be Appalachia at the time. The dinosaurs of Laramidia are phenomenally well known. This is where we get these giant two-fingered tyrannosaurs, the great diversity of the ceratopsids or horned dinosaurs, the great diversity of the duckbill dinosaurs, and many others. And we've known more species from the last 15 million years of the Cretaceous, of Western North America, than in much of the rest of dinosaur diversity throughout the Mesozoic all put together. It's a phenomenally diverse area. And the question has been, is there something about the nature of Laramidia that was an engine for driving dinosaur diversity? And one suggestion was, it's a narrow area, changing sea levels could easily separate populations, allowing them to speciate, and then when the sea levels drop again, they rejoin, so now you have multiple taxa, where once you just had a single species. Repeated episodes of that driving up this great diversity. Well, it's an interesting idea, but we have to consider other possibilities. And one aspect is, Laramidian dinosaurs are often known by multiple individuals at multiple growth stages. And this has led to oversplitting of the species to the point where sometimes the juveniles, the subadults, and the adults of the same taxon were given separate names. That's not an issue when your dinosaur community consists of a single individual that you find. You have only one individual, you're not going to confuse it ontogenetically. Also, Laramidia is sort of the perfect storm in terms of generating and finding fossils. In terms of the generation of it, it was an area that was undergoing a lot of geologic uplift during the late Cretaceous. The second and third waves of the generation of the Western North American Cordillera, the Sevier orogeny and the Laramide orogeny, are going on, generating lots of sediment. That sediment's draining down through a very relatively narrow area between the mountains themselves and the Western Interior Seaway. So you're dumping a lot of material in a small area, and that means you're accumulating very thick packages of sediment, which means that at any given interval of time is represented by a fair amount of thickness of sediment. So because of that, we have many, many layers within any given formation that are well-preserving fossil assemblages. And so we tend to get many, many species found in these formations. The traditional method has been either to lump formations all together as a single unit, or to generate time bins on the scale of about 5 million years or so. But it turns out recent study looking at the detailed fine-level stratigraphy and dating within these formations show that the fossil dinosaur species should persist for much less than a million years, like maybe 500,000, 800,000 years for a given species. So if you're looking at 5 million-year intervals, you're actually lumping five successive faunas together, and not surprisingly, getting a more diverse assemblage than you do from a fauna known from a single time slice. So I think what the data are currently showing is that although Laramidia is diverse, it is probably not unrepresentatively diverse for the Mesozoic. And if we had better sampling of other times and other places, we probably would find as complex and diverse communities of dinosaurs throughout the Cretaceous and the Jurassic. So a pretty well-packed world in terms of of the disparity of forms, the differences among forms, the number of species, and so forth.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom.
Great, thanks. Glad I had this opportunity.
So I've just come across a poster on the Paleocene radiation of some ungulate-like placentals with Sarah Shelley. Can you tell us a little bit about your poster?
Yep, so what we're doing is resolving the phylogenetic relationships of Charypticidae, which are this subgroup of Condylarthra, which is this wastebasket taxon of placental mammals that you find just after the KPG mass extinction. So we've managed to produce a reasonably well-resolved phylogeny, and are also looking at these two larger Charypticids, Ectoconus and Charypticus. Managed to produce body masses for each of these, and the Ectoconus, which we thought would be maybe 40 or 50 kilos, came out about 100 kilos. We then plotted limb lengths into morphospace, and Ectoconus is plotting out in this sort of graviportal region of morphospace. So these things evolved larger body sizes without first becoming or developing the ability to run.
That's really interesting. Can you tell us, for people who don't know what condylarths are, what kind of animals these, what they would have looked like?
Good question. So they're archaic ungulates. So they're related to, somehow related to modern ungulates, which are the hoofed animals. Some of them had hooves, not all of them had hooves. Some of them were really small, kind of like rodent-like creatures. Some of them were really big, more like sort of sheep, pigs maybe. They're pretty odd. There's no sort of modern analogue for what these things look like. So Charypticus was sort of like an aardvark crossed with a sheep, crossed with a dog, crossed with a tapir. They're weird, basically.
So is there a specific reason why you're studying these animals at this point in time? Is it telling you anything specific about the Paleocene or biogeography?
So these are some of the first animals to get big after the KPG mass extinction. There's massive radiation, a load of niches, and these animals sort of just went nuts. And then eventually we'll be looking at things like weight, seeing how fast they evolved, disparity, body size.
Very cool. So you are a PhD student at the University of Edinburgh, is that right?
Yep, with Steve Fossati.
And have you just started, or are you first year?
Going into second year. Well, in second year, just started second year.
Cool. So look forward to hearing more about this in the future.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah.
So I'm with Jennifer Bradham of Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and she's been looking at peccaries. Why is a peccary?
Peccaries are Tiasuids. They're closely related and kind of look similar to pigs, except these guys are, they have this long, really beautiful, kind of spiny, stiff hair, and at least modern peccaries, most of them live in a forested environment.
Okay, so why have you been looking at them?
So I'm kind of looking at peccary diet through time. So we have an extinct group of Platygonus and Mylohyus, and then an extant group of peccaries from Brazil. And we're using three-dimensional dental microwear texture analysis and isotopes to understand how their diet fluctuates through time, and if that diet, as exhibited through microwear, corresponds to the environment and changes in the environment through isotopes.
So the microwear is just like the kind of grooves and stuff left on the teeth based on what they've been eating, is that right?
It's a quantification of microscopic wear patterns on the occlusal surface, the chewing surface of the tooth, due to what you eat.
Okay, so what is their diet in the modern ones that we can see?
So modern ones that we can see eat a lot of fruits, nuts. In some places in Brazil, they've been known to actually eat fish and roots, and like aqueous tubers during times of low food availability, but preferentially they eat fruits and seeds mostly.
So how did you find this out? Did you have to sit in the Brazilian rainforest for months and months observing peccaries and what they ate?
Actually, I did spend the last 2.5 months this past summer in the Brazilian rainforest watching peccaries. But two of the scientists that I work with down there, Alexini Karuglian and Malu Georgi, are actively monitoring live populations, and this is all kind of like firsthand visual sight information through camera traps and watching. Yeah.
And so you compared the teeth of the extinct to the teeth of the extant, is that right?
Right. So we did a microarray analysis on the extinct, teeth of the extinct and teeth of the extant. And then we also did another analysis on extinct peccaries from a bunch of different environments, expecting to see differences in their microarray. But from this initial study, we don't see any differences in microarray between all these different environments in Brazil. But we do see a large difference between in the microarray of the extinct peccaries versus the extant peccaries. So according to this analysis, our extinct peccaries are eating similar diets and our extant peccaries are eating similar diets, but they're very different from each other. And potentially, it's showing that extant peccaries are eating harder objects than the extinct peccaries.
And why might that be?
Potentially availability. These are Pleistocene specimens, so perhaps in the Pleistocene, there were either less nuts and things like that available, or something else was filling that niche.
Okay, and where do you hope to take your peccary research in the future?
I hope that some of this, some of the isotope studies in the future work that we're doing is able to be used for conservation purposes. But we plan to expand the study into broadly large mammals and their impacts on the environment and vice versa, and how that fluctuates through time, pre-Pleistocene and then after the extinction and then a modern study.
Are peccaries endangered?
They are not endangered. They are considered vulnerable by the IUCN at the moment, but vulnerable with populations decreasing. So it could be dangerous. Could be endangered in the future.
And what are they like? Are they pretty friendly animals? Or?
It depends who
you ask. I don't know anything about them.
Oh, they're the cutest things ever. It depends who you ask. So hunters and natives in Brazil will say they're the most dangerous animal in the forest. But those of us who study them and spend long periods of time in the jungle tracking them, they're not threatening at all, and they won't attack you unless you threaten them in some way. At one point, three of us were tracking peccaries through the forest, and our guide told us to stop. And about 30 seconds later, we were surrounded by a herd of peccaries that were just passing the left of us and passing the right of us, and they stopped in front to eat fruit, and they didn't even acknowledge our existence until I took a picture and the flash scared them away. Yeah. So no, not dangerous at all. They're very, they do defend their young very stiffly though. So if you threaten the young, they will all protect it.
So you've never been attacked by a peccary?
No, never attacked by a peccary. Never felt threatened by a peccary. Really, really sweet animals, I think. But if you do, they've been known to attack hunters though, who have like dogs and stuff who are, potentially like harming them or threatening the herd. And what they do is they clack their teeth really loudly together as to confuse the predator. They've been known to surround jaguars and cougars and chomp their teeth really loudly to make these loud noises to scare and confuse the predator so he doesn't know which one to attack and retreats.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.